I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Since the opening of Millennium Park in Chicago, parks have become the hottest urban amenity. But Char Miller, Director of Urban Studies at Trinity University, reminds us that this is the second golden age of parks. Bold civic visions in the 19th century gave us the great parks we enjoy today, and we'll find out what we can learn from that earlier era that can lead to better parks for cities. And we'll talk to Ben Shields, who's tracking the elusive sports fan and how urban entertainment marketers can find their audience. That's all today on Smart City, but first, this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Char Miller specializes in American environmental and urban history. Since 2001, Char has been director of urban studies at Trinity University, where he is also a professor of history. Char is a contributing writer to the Texas Observer. He's on the City of San Antonio's Open Space Advisory Board and its Tree Preservation Ordinance Panel. While on leave in 2004-2005, Char was the P.G. Roosevelt Lecturer for the Theodore Roosevelt Association and the Centennial Lecturer for the U.S. Forest Service. We now take our great national parks and urban parks for granted. It's hard to remember that once none of these parks existed, and it took people with big visions to make these parks a reality. How did our great parks get started?
Well, people like Frederick Law Olmsted in the middle part of the 19th century were really critical to articulating why we needed parks and then creating the plans for their construction. And, you know, it's one of those moments in which a whole profession emerged in the late 19th century, or middle to late 19th century, of landscape architecture. There had been parks before, but never had a place like New York thought about building a central park, or in time the Golden Gate Park in San Francisco or Grant Park in Chicago. All of a sudden it became linked to the incredible growth of these communities and the rapid loss of open space, issues, by the way, that we're still confronting. But it took sort of these visionaries like Olmsted and his peers to recognize that because you had a lot of people, they would need some open space somewhere. But it couldn't have happened before the Industrial Revolution. I mean, that's the irony of it. We had to go through this extraordinary explosion of economic activity before we recognized what we had lost.
And how did Olmsted get – he was a professional. He was going to, in effect, benefit personally from building these parks, designing these parks. So how did he get the people who were paying for these parks interested?
Well, that's actually a great question, and it's part of what I think made Olmsted and Calbert Vaugh, his colleague, so good at what they did. They have an idea. A great park is necessary for a city, but cities don't know that they needed great parks. But I think the larger pitch was as following, that cities needed to think about public health, that parks were part of public health issues. And in addition, part of the argument in the 19th century anyway was we are losing the rural culture from which all of these migrants to the United States came and from which the United States itself had been, and that a great central city park would be a way to recapture what Olmsted called breathing spaces, the capacity for people. They were the lungs of the city. So he used the metaphor of the body, he used the argument of health, and he made a claim, an appeal to almost a kind of rural nostalgia that we would have a hard time dealing with because we're so suburbanized at this point. But it worked in the 19th century and I think was therefore very successful in getting politicians, many of whom, frankly, could have cared less. Nonetheless, because Olmsted and his peers seemed to offer a benefit, an array of benefits to them, they leapt at it, as ultimately with their citizens.
Did it ultimately, Char, become a trend or a civic pride sort of thing in the way that, pedestrian malls and festival marketplaces became in earlier eras, the 70s, for instance, in cities where one city did one and the second city did it and then everyone had to do it,
right,
or you would be left behind, you wouldn't be a proud city.
Right.
Did the movement ever catch on in that way?
Oh, absolutely. And you can imagine how it plays out. If the moment that New York City talked about a Central Park, you can imagine every other city going, wait a second, if New York has it, we have to have it. And you can actually sort of track the genealogy, which, by the way, has worked to the landscape architect's great benefit, because the moment someone like Olmsted created Central Park, well, everybody not only wants a Central Park, they want the man who created the Central Park. Mm-hmm. And so his professional career takes off in that regard. And as you're absolutely right, we've seen that happen time and time again across urban spaces in the United States. And so the festival malls, every city has an old town. Well, where did that come from? Well, the old towns were always there. But the moment Chicago and others started to develop it, everybody said, well, wait a second, maybe we shouldn't tear down all of this city. Maybe we should keep this little old section here and sort of use it for tourism. Well, it turns out once you've done that, you might as well be in Omaha or Chicago or San Antonio or Houston or wherever it is, because they all have them. But it is, they're sort of real estate speculation schemes on the one hand, but also public benefits on the other. And you know, okay, that works. Apparently it works.
To get a sense of the magnitude of the accomplishment of these urban parks, what could we do today that would be its equivalent?
Wow. That is really hard to imagine, frankly, because the nature of American cities now, the physical nature of them is so massive, certainly for those cities in the American West like San Antonio and Houston, which are, you know, 500-700 square miles in extent. It's hard to know how you could capture something so monumental. I mean, New York City's Central Park or Grant Park or Golden Gate Park, I think, are unique to their times. To build a similar kind of park would be very tough to capture the imagination, though San Antonio was in the process of doing that with a 300-acre north of the city park that actually is going to serve a massive part of the city where there are no parks. So there's possibilities there. But I think what made the 19th century so dynamic and so compelling is that they got there just at the moment when everything was starting to change. Now that we're in largely automobile-driven cities, figuring out a way to get people out of those cars, if you could figure out ways to get people out of those cars, then in fact we might actually have achieved something that the 19th century achieved.
Well, that raises a point. There seems to be today a resurgence of interest in open space and parklands,
yes.
And
yes,
you see a lot of those parklands being imagined as ribbons, as links,
yes,
as connections, rather than a place to which you take public transportation or your own car and then park and then get out and enjoy that space. It seems that now you're seeing the ribbons of green space. What do you attribute that?
Well, I think in part we're going to ribbons because we don't have any other larger spaces with which to work. I've served on the Open Space Advisory Board for San Antonio, for example, for a number of years. And what we came up with because of this very factor of the lack of space that we could have used for a grand park was to use the various watersheds that flow through the city. In fact, there's five of them. So it really becomes the metaphor becomes that of a hand, mm-hmm, in which you go and use these, as you describe them, these ribbons, these linear parks, because frankly, that's all that you can get your hands on. And yet, it also, I think, serves a public interest that is quite profound. If you take a watershed or an old railway line, for example, that runs through and past a series of neighborhoods, now you have connected these neighborhoods one to the other through green space. But you've also given them neighborhood parks. That's just a different kind of neighborhood park. And so the so-called Emerald Necklace in Atlanta, in which they're using 20 to 30 miles of rail lines that connect many, many neighborhoods, they've developed a scheme whereby you have a sense of ownership for the park in your neighborhood, but you also know it's linked to other places. And I think that's really how we will sort of finesse the loss of open space in a grand sense and reinvent cities as sort of green alleyways in some sense, linking up neighborhoods that visually don't seem like they're connected until you recognize that there is, in fact, a natural connection, literally a natural connection, a watershed or something like that, that pulls these places together. And I think intellectually what that does is to remind us that we actually live in in natural systems. We don't tend to believe that because we live in cars with air conditioning and radios and all these other kinds of things. We don't think of ourselves as living in an environment that's functioning. But the moment you open up these ribbons, these little sort of fingers on a hand, suddenly everybody's conception of the spaces they inhabit changes. And I think that's for the good.
Do you see this becoming a new trend? Are we back now to the time when parks or linear parks are viewed as great civic amenities?
Oh, yeah, I think we are.
Are we back in a competition?
I hope so. I love the competition in part because it, in fact, produces results. And I think that's one of the ways in which cities around the country who are eager for new populations, new economic activities, they're all starting to pitch lifestyle. And that part of lifestyle is about parks and recreation, about the capacity to get on your bike and to ride safely, not necessarily only on city streets, but in fact safely along linear parks for tens of 20s of miles. And again, San Antonio is an example of a place that's starting to think about that through its missions and the Riverwalk and all of these other amenities. But lots of cities have been at this model for some time. What I think is exciting about it is that it means that parks and recreation's budgets tend to fluctuate with political lifestyles and the like, and they're starting to emerge in strong ways. Small towns like Boise, Idaho, which are using their rivers as these extraordinarily beautiful walk, bike, hike trails, now can turn around to potential employers and say, look at what we have to offer your employees if you move here. And so the competition isn't just about green space. It's what green space can create in terms of green the money. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes a really powerful message to give to the community itself, but then the community to sell itself to other places.
I'm curious about the argument you just described, the green space equals green money. Was that the same argument made when we built Central Park and the great Grant Park and the great parks that we know and enjoy today?
It was not explicit. However, if you look at Central Park today, especially an aerial view of it, and you note what's happened on Park Avenue and to the west and the north and the south, those canyons that erected around it. Well, anybody who had any sense in the sort of 1870s period went up and bought land like crazy. The park created an urban land scheme around it. And Olmsted understood that was going to happen. I mean, he has this wonderful line about, we have to do this now before the rest of the city is obliterated. And the irony is, of course, the moment you create the park, you create the economic engine that's going to, in fact, absorb all of the land around it, because who wouldn't want to have a Central Park view? As Jackie Onassis and other people have paid millions of dollars to get that view, suddenly parks become economic generators. And in that way, as awkward as that is, I think planners have to keep that in mind, precisely because you need to get these lands before something else happens, but you also must recognize once you have these parks, they are going to create their own secondary economic activity that's going to, over time, potentially tax the very park you've just created.
So we're more comfortable today making the economic argument, but it was always there.
Yeah, we're much more comfortable making it. I think we're and perhaps wisely so. I mean, we understand that economics drives a lot of urban development processes.
What is it, Char, about a particular park? Not every park creates that kind of economic impact. Is there something about – can you generalize the characteristics of parks that really have that tremendous impact on the surrounding real estate values?
I think part of what you're looking at is parks that are built in different kinds of cities. And again, Central Park is sort of the classic model, so let's use that. New York City was in the 19th century a tremendously dense place. It's even more dense today. And the very fact of population density makes for a vibrant park internal to the park itself, and also a very lively street scene in and around that park. And it's not simply the museums that are there or the hotels and the like that helps do this. It's the park itself that really becomes the kind of hub around which people's ideas and imaginations are let loose. My wife was just up in Central Park this weekend and called me up and said, you can't believe, and started listing the number of uses that she saw playing out in the park. And there were hundreds of them in the languages. So you're looking at a place that is drawing off a very large population base. In towns that are less dense, often Western towns, LA, Denver, Phoenix, and the like, it's a little more complicated for a park to do that because, in fact, these cities have not built up, they've built out. And so, therefore, are much less dense and therefore much less compact and therefore have a smaller population that will necessarily flock to a central park of one kind or another and use it in a variety of ways. It may be simply too far away from them to do that expeditiously. And there's not mass transit and the like that would lure you there. So that's another reason why these linear parks, neighborhood located parks, may in these big sprawling urban landscapes be much more functional and much more integrated into people's lives than the big blockbuster park like Central Park or Grant or Golden Gate and places like that.
It wasn't too long ago that Central Park was in pretty sorry shape.
Yes.
And
yes,
the Central Park Conservancy was formed as a private not-for-profit. The city put the money it had been spending on Central Park into the Conservancy, I think,
yes,
or they were able then to use a mix of volunteers and I think city employees. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Is that the new model for park management?
I think it is. Herman Park in Houston, like Central Park, like the Battery Park Conservancy, and others of that ilk are all a mixture of public and private dollars. And I think part of what that's a reflection of is since the middle 1970s, the squeezing of public budgets, of city budgets, away from spending funds on parks, in part because there's an anti-tax ethos in this country that has basically starved many city administrations. And so they've been doing what you do, which is to slash and burn. But unfortunately, they've gone after the things that are also the amenities of these areas. And New York City was a reflection of that. Lots of places were. But what's so wonderful about the Conservancy in Central Park is the way in which its leadership has managed to not only create an enormous amount of public goodwill around the work that it's done, but that goodwill translates into donations, which translates into additional renovations on the park, the upgrading and the maintenance, which is really the most crucial park, as every city has discovered of late. It isn't the bond that you pass to create the park that matters, though it does. What really matters is if you can create an endowment for the maintenance of that space, because in 10 years, what you created is going to be worn and torn and needs to be mended. And if you don't have capital to do that, then you're back in the cycle in which you've created something lovely only to see it fall apart.
You teach a class at Trinity called The City in History.
Yeah.
What can we learn from history about our cities that could help guide us in urban decision-making today?
Well, I think, first of all, and this is something I stress with my students, the fact that cities have a history matters. That is to say that they have changed in their form and function over time is really critical. It's critical, I think, in part because we tend to only live in the present. Not a bad thing. That's where we're operating. But we don't recognize that we're also living in the past, that there were other possibilities that we didn't take in park development, let's say, or in street design or mass transit, and that there were reasons why we didn't make those decisions and we chose another model. And so part of what I try to do in that class, and I think many urban historians do, who are also engaged in the public life of their communities at the time in which they're living, is to make it clear to us that we have a consciousness about, that there is a consciousness about this past that can help better articulate why we need to build more parks, let's say, or consider mass transit in a city which has very little of it, or in which we think about, say, flood control or riparian parks of one form or another, because we have these natural features. And that's another thing that I think has emerged in since the 1970s, really, is the conception of cities as environments. They're not just places where people live.
As you study the history of cities, what do you conclude about the nature of their leadership? Do you see any patterns among leaders who have been especially successful?
The model for urban leadership and the success of those models really depends upon two factors. One, the individuals, obviously, but the other has to do with the political structures in which those individuals operate. So that somebody like Michael Bloomberg, or Rudy Giuliani or Ed Koch in New York, operating in a very strong mayoral model with capacities, in the case of New York City, to even take over the school districts, are models that work really wonderfully if you have very strong personalities, and those three guys have pretty strong personalities and egos. In other cities where you have a city manager form of government, and there's lots in the South and the West for which this is true, what you've created is a weak mayor model that's really driven, a city that's really driven by its city manager, and therefore success in one model cannot be translated into another. And I think part of the diversity of the American urban system is that there's multiples of these models, which means that cities, frankly, function in different ways, and therefore mayoral candidates have to figure this out and think out how they can function best within the restrictions that they have to operate within.
Jar, it's been fun talking with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
No, my great pleasure. Thank you.
Char Miller's Director of Urban Studies and a Professor of History at Trinity University. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetta's assistant editor, Nate Berg.
This week, the United States Supreme Court passed a ruling that could allow the Federal Endangered Species Act to go largely ignored when developments are being planned and approved. In what is being viewed as a victory for developers, a 5-4 majority ruled that the Environmental Protection Agency would not be required to make sure state-approved developments are in compliance with the Endangered Species Act. The EPA can grant states the right to determine whether plans for development are in accordance with the Federal Clean Water Act, and it often does. At issue in the case was that states are not allowed to enforce the Endangered Species Act, and by allowing them to approve plans based on restrictions outlined in the Clean Water Act, states could essentially ignore the Endangered Species Act, and the EPA would have no legal responsibility to prevent it. While the Endangered Species Act itself may now be endangered, Forbes recently published a series about the world's cities that may be in danger of extinction. With younger populations largely fleeing rural areas and global warming raising sea levels into and over coastal areas, many of our cities and towns simply might not be around in the year 2100. These 21st century ghost cities are likely to include many towns in such states as Kansas and the Dakotas, as well as distant and rural farming communities in increasingly urbanizing countries like Japan. With populations that are primarily elderly, these areas are likely to fade away. And as mounting evidence suggests no stop to rising global temperatures, many of the planet's coastal and low-lying areas may soon slip into the seas. But before doom and gloom can overtake the entire globe, some cities are experiencing a successful growth of both their populations and their economies. A recent article in the Wall Street Journal takes a look at how some of these cities are using old-fashioned streetcar systems to spur economic activity. Portland, Oregon's streetcar system is cited as one of the most widely used systems in the country, but it is most notably recognized for its success in drawing in business to the community. Cities such as Tampa, Florida, Kenosha, Wisconsin, and Little Rock, Arkansas have seen a tide of redevelopment and revitalization follow wherever their streetcar systems have gone. Many other cities are looking to enjoy similar economic jolts by planning their own streetcars. But first, they have to win the fight for state and federal transit funding, much of which often goes to admittedly faster and more widely used transit systems. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Ben Shields is co-author of Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace. He's a frequent media commentator and speaker on the sports marketing industry and is host of the Elusive Fan podcast, which offers bi-weekly analysis of sports fan connection strategies. He's currently completing his PhD in communication studies at Northwestern University. Ben, I woke up this summer morning to the sound of NPR reporters telling me the score of the Chicago Sky. That's Chicago's WNBA team, so the women will play basketball all summer, and the men play through June and begin again in, October? And that's just professional basketball. How are all these teams surviving?
Well, the short answer to your question is they aren't. We are in a sports industry where the problems have been more pronounced than any time in our history. You talk about professional, college, and even high school sports, not only in this country, but also globally. The amount of sports that are vying for the time and money of the fan are absolutely mind-boggling. And the bottom line is, Carol, is that in today's sports industry, those traditional sports, the basketballs, the hockeys, are now being challenged by sports like paintball, lacrosse, rugby, international sports like cricket. So you've got the NBA Finals. In terms of the television ratings, the Sunday night game was beat in the ratings by The Sopranos by more than 3 million people. The NHL Stanley Cup Finals, which used to be one of the most hallowed tournaments in sports, is now in a situation where one of their games on NBC was the network's lowest rated game in the history of the network. This is the situation that we're dealing with in the sports industry today. We've got all this competition, lots of new technologies and ways that people are interacting with the game, and it's almost a crisis situation for anyone in sports trying to connect with that fan and get their time and money.
So what is the sports marketer to do?
Well, first of all, it starts with the product. Any marketer needs to understand what the product is and how they can actually communicate it. Keep in mind, marketing is not about strategies and tactics right up front. It's not just promoting the product. It starts with developing that strong product. Give you a great example of what happens here in the town of Chicago. The Chicago Bulls obviously went through a tough time after Michael Jordan left. But what they've begun to do is build the team to represent a brand. Hardworking. Persistent. They will not allow a superstar type to come onto the team because it doesn't fit with their blueprint. So you've got a situation where the Chicago Bulls, yes, their team strategy is to play hard defense and to really be very gritty. But the residual effect of that is it's a very strong brand identity that people in Chicago or people all across the world can say, look, the Chicago Bulls stand for a hardworking, gritty team. We understand that, and that we know anytime we watch them on television, anytime we go to the stadium, we're going to get that product of hardworking basketball. It's something that the sports industry has never really considered because, let's face it, teams and leagues are not like detergent, okay? You cannot control how a team is going to perform. So it's up to the sports marketer to say, look, we're dealing with all this competition. Fans just aren't going to come because there's a game going on. So we need to be able to not only improve the product, but to provide experiences around the product. Easy parking. Technological experiences that allow fans to interact with the players. Other entertainment type experiences, whether it's concerts or tie-ins with music or fashion. There's a new era in sports marketing that's asking these sports marketers to say, look, let's take this product and then provide the fan with a multitude of experiences to help bring them in times when the team loses.
Is the sports fan indeed elusive, or is the sports fan's attention just more fragmented?
Yeah, absolutely. Television's the best example. You've got satellite television and cable with over 100 channels, Carol. Look, the bottom line is when you've got all these types of sporting events that are competing with not only other entertainment, but restaurants, Costco, the theater. All of this is this huge hothouse of competition that is taking the time and money away from the sports fan. So this is a competitive environment that we've never seen.
Are there as many sports fans as ever, but they're just more fragmented today?
That's the good news. The sports industry is growing at unbelievable levels. Conservative estimates by PricewaterhouseCoopers puts the sports market at $100 billion globally. But that's conservative. I would venture to say that it's more close to $500 billion or even $1 trillion. So sports is growing across the globe. Part of that is because of the new technology. Okay, we've got sports like soccer, cricket, rugby, that are now becoming global competitors here in this country. The fact that I can watch on satellite television the English Premier League means that the local teams here are competing with them in England because of that technology. So not only is sports growing, the technology is there that's spreading the product across a wide variety of distribution channels. I was actually speaking with the global sponsorship manager of the International Cricket Council earlier this week, and he's talking about how in India there are millions of people that are sports fans, and they all love cricket. But what sports leagues, not only in the United States but also in Europe, are beginning to look at is how to branch into markets like India, how to branch into markets like China. In fact, the National Basketball Association just announced that they are going to start an NBA-branded basketball league in China. It just gives you a sense of this international flavor. I will tell you that I don't think there's a more competitive industry in the world than sports. And for marketers, not just in sports, but entertainment or even product marketers, I think we're going to be able to see some of the most cutting-edge strategies come from the sports industry because it is so difficult to get that fan's time and money.
What are some of those cutting-edge technologies in play today?
First of all, there's technology integration. It used to be that the fan interacted with sports, going to the stadium, watching on television, or listening in the radio. What we're seeing in sports now is taking technology to a whole new interactive level. Have you heard of fantasy sports, Carol?
Yes, I have.
At least 16 million people play it in this country. It's growing into a $1.5 to $2 billion industry. And what we're seeing in fantasy is that fans are becoming their own owner, general manager, and coach of their own professional sports team. Using technology, it used to be in the 80s when the internet and personal computer weren't around, people would have to sit there and compute all the scores with pens and paper. But what the internet has enabled them to do is grow the fantasy industry. In sports, and I would argue for all of entertainment, there is no more engaged fan than that fantasy fan. And the strategy there is to allow fans that interactive experience to take players themselves and make them their own. Fantasy sports is not so different from what we're seeing with YouTube, with what we're seeing with MySpace, Facebook. It's the fan as the center of attention. And that's just one strategy that we're seeing. In other words, look, the eras of a passive audience member are over. Although people like to sit on couches and play with the remote control, that's just a former pastime. Fans and audiences want to be involved with their entertainment experience. American Idol, the most popular television property in this country, is founded upon that. With the voting, the criticism of the performers, just like the judges do. Okay? So that's the new entertainment world that we're operating in. And using technology to create more interaction with the fan and the sport is really the key.
How do you put the fan at the center in the physical realm? Attending a game with a half-full arena is just not nearly as much fun.
One of the major issues, of course, is getting fans to the actual game. And I want to deal with this first before I get along to your question. Now, getting fans to the game in a city like Chicago, or basically any major city across the United States, is a major issue because of the transportation problems that are facing cities today. Okay, so cities need to begin to work with professional and college teams to create those pathways to enable fans to actually get to the games. Failing that, I think we're going to see a return to barnstorming in this country. You remember barnstorming in the 1920s, 1930s, where baseball teams would travel around and go to the fans? So one of the issues with attendance is, instead of making the fans come to you, Why not make the team go to the fans? We're already seeing this in Major League Baseball, in the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, who are experiencing major attendance problems for a long time. What they've tried to do is they played one regular season series in Orlando. So they went to a smaller stadium where they got to have a packed house and build regional support around the team. So that's one issue, trying to at least make it easier for fans to get to the actual stadium. Having said that, once they're in the stadium, I think we're going to need to bring in some at-home technologies into the stadium itself, okay? So I have to be honest with you. During a very cold day, a football game, would you rather be at the game or would you rather be at home watching it on your 60-inch HDTV television with surround sound? I know there are some people that would love to be at the game and really feel like they're a part of the experience. But what we're seeing is the technology is there for fans to actually have a very satisfying entertainment experience at their home. What does that mean for the stadium? If you're talking about that half-empty basketball arena, I say bring in technologies that one would expect at the home into the stadium. We're already seeing this with NASCAR. Interestingly enough, NASCAR has begun to introduce a handheld device where they can see on television the various angles in the cars themselves. They can listen to the driver communications through this device. So it's combining some of these technologies that fans have become used to at home with the attendance experience itself. Because that's one of the issues. When you've got a great technological experience at home, why leave and actually pay money to go to the stadium? So A, it's actually getting fans to the stadium, making it much easier for them to get there. But it's also satisfying their expectations. And the expectations in today's digital age really have changed to say that, look, fans are going to want what they get at home at the stadium.
Who is today's sports fan?
Today's sports fan varies. I venture to say that on some level, almost every American is a sports fan. Now, I don't want to offend anyone that hates sports, but the bottom line is you go into any workplace, there's going to be water cooler talk about sports. Sports is one of those communication topics that cross all boundaries. It's not politics. It's not religion. So we can sit here in an office and talk about sports and not really offend anyone. So it's a communication topic that really is embedded in the nation's cities. And so, you know, again, I don't want to offend people by presuming that they're a sports fan, but ultimately it's a part of our culture, and I think it's growing in importance as well.
In such a crowded market and with sports readily available on TV 24 hours a day, how is the sports fan changing?
Sports fans changing because they have more control. It's an era of customization, personalization. Really, the philosophy in the sports world today is to give the fan as much information in as many channels as possible. ESPN, of course, is the avatar for this because they are basically taking hold of every distribution channel that fans use to access sports information and putting their content in it. And that's really the model that we're seeing in all of entertainment. Giving the fan control, letting them put it together the way that they want to, and ultimately, they can make the decisions on how they want to experience sports. That's today's sports fan.
Knowing what you know about the crowded sports market and the elusive fan, if you were mayor, would you invest in a sports team for your community?
That's a complicated issue, but to answer your question directly, yes, absolutely. Let me preface this by saying there have been economic studies in this country that have overwhelmingly showed that investment in professional stadiums has not returned economically what politicians, citizens, and the teams themselves had hoped for. Having said that, there are intangible benefits to having a sports team in a city. If you think about a city like Minneapolis, where the Twins are the baseball team, and they've also got NHL, NBA, and NFL team. Let me ask you this question, Carol. What would Minneapolis be without those professional teams?
Let me push back. Now that so many cities have teams, does that line really mean anything anymore?
You cannot tell me that what goes on at Wrigley Field, they've been branded as lovable losers. You can't tell me that that doesn't build community. Now, we deal with this issue a lot in the communication field. And a lot of communication scholars say this: the city is under crisis because of all these technologies that are fragmenting people and leaving them in their homes or with their iPods on the train. Now, sports is the only and probably the largest shared experience that communities have today. You go into Wrigley Field, U.S. Cellular Field, the numbers of people in that community situation far outnumber any other shared experience in the city. Look, you go to museums, perhaps movie theaters, the theater itself. The fact is, you don't have thousands of people that are in one area sharing that experience. So in the technological age, when everyone is in their own enclave, perhaps, looking to really build community, sports is an excellent vehicle for that. And so although the economic benefits, based on some of the studies, now there are limitations to these studies, but bringing people into the city, bringing people into these sports venues, having people talk about sports at work, at home, at school, you can't really place a value on it. But I can tell you this, the value is there.
You mentioned the Cubs as lovable losers. Is there any way to enjoy marketing success if your team is not winning?
That's the goal in the elusive fan. And the Cubs are a great example of that. The counterexample is the Atlanta Braves, who until last year won about 13 or 14 division championships and have struggled with attendance. So the key is, as a sports marketer, to develop the brand that can transcend winning and losing seasons. That's through brand building by developing a clear identity for the team, like the Chicago Bulls example I cited. That's through actually using new experiences to entertain the fan that are independent of the product on the field. So look, the myth in sports all along has been that, you know, if the team loses, people aren't going to show up. I can tell you this. We as sports marketers cannot do anything for the Pittsburgh Pirates, who have been losing for a number of years now. If you're a perennial loser, it's very difficult for marketing to take over because, as I mentioned, the product itself is not satisfactory. But if you've got a decent product, then marketing can take over and help keep those fans no matter what the record is.
What then is the kiss of death in sports marketing?
Loss of credibility. There's a concept called ethos that we deal with a lot in communication, and that's ultimately credibility. And you see a sport like track and field. Used to be one of the most popular sports in this country, not of the world. And we've seen in the last few years where the athletes themselves have been implicated with performance-enhancing drugs. The stars of the sports have either been found guilty or alleged. So you as the fan, you're watching this track and field event, and you're thinking to yourself, is what I'm watching the real thing? Is this true competition? So credibility in terms of performance-enhancing drugs is a huge issue. But credibility can come in other forms in sports. It can be an owner that has a fire sale of the team that makes the fans upset. It can be the player himself or herself that is notorious for being unfriendly to the fans. So if you have a credible product, no matter whether you win or lose, and your owner and everyone else in the organization, from the president to the parking attendant, represent that credibility, you can win in sports marketing.
Can you categorize generic sports strategies that work?
Sure. First and foremost, you have to understand your audience. There's always been a conflict in sports about segmentation and targeting. People have always said that sports should be all things to all people. They're a public good. We shouldn't be targeting certain fan groups. The problem is, in today's fragmented society, it's simply not working anymore. Take a sport like Ultimate Fighting Championship, which is mixed martial arts. Now, what's happened here is this has been an excellent transformation case because prior to the UFC becoming so popular, they were a very rugged and violent sport. Now, this is mixed martial arts, and it's essentially humans just going at one another with no regard for their life. And what the UFC did was to implement new rules to make it more acceptable to an audience. And that audience was specifically targeted, 18 to 34-year-old males. They signed a television deal with Spike TV, which is a niche channel that appeals to 18 to 34-year-old males. The results are this. UFC routinely outdraws in television ratings some of these ingrained sports like Major League Baseball and the National Basketball Association. It's also selling out arenas all across the country and commanding a huge percentage of revenue in pay-per-view. So you've got UFC, or mixed martial arts, targeting specifically an 18 to 34-year-old male demographic and reaping incredible rewards. So I would urge anyone that's in sports marketing to begin to think about segmentation. Again, I agree that sports on some level can be all things to all people. But in such a competitive environment, you've got to segment, target, and position yourself to actually connect with a specific market segment if you're going to make it in sports.
What can arts and culture marketers learn from good sports marketing?
Ultimately, sports is a very difficult product to control. We talked about this earlier, the fact that the face of the team is always gone, especially in the era of free agency. The performance of the team is an issue. If you take a look at a museum or even a theater, they're dealing with the same issue. They've got a changing product. There's a new exhibit. There's a new show. And so what they need to understand is how their attendance experience, just like we were talking about in sports, can stand alone on itself. What is it about the museum? What is it about the theater itself? What is it about the park that can bring spectators in regardless of what's being shown there? And so that's one of the interesting parallels, what the product is being showcased and how marketers themselves can deal with the issues that they can control and market those as opposed to what ultimately will be a changing product in the theater, in the museum, or on the sports field.
Do arts marketers have an opportunity to put the fan at the center, the patron at the center?
Absolutely. One of the issues, though, is artistic integrity. I've heard this complaint from artists for a long time, especially with this new American Idol model. They say that, look, our artistic integrity is on the line if we let the fans be involved in creating the art. Now, I have to tell you, I understand that argument, I respect it, but things are going to have to change. And it's not so much giving up all artistic integrity, but allowing the fan to play some role in this entertainment experience. Symphony orchestras, museums, whatever the case may be, there needs to be new opportunities for fans to get involved, otherwise they're going to go elsewhere.
Ben Shields is co-author of The Elusive Fan, Reinventing Sports in a Crowded Marketplace. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Are you making plans for your retirement? CityView's commentator Walker Smith offers one option you may not have considered.
I like to brag on my dad. He's 84 and still gets up every morning to put in a full day at the office. Admittedly, he's been lucky with his health, so he's able to do more than many others his age. It's just that he puts his good fortune to good use, which I admire. My dad is a throwback. Today, only 14% of those 65 and older work full-time. But this wasn't always so. As late as 1930, nearly 60% of men 65 and older worked. In the late 19th century, it was two-thirds to three-quarters. It's only since the establishment of Social Security in 1935 that an old age of leisure-filled retirement has become the norm. Before then, Nobody would have thought twice about my dad working into his 80s. Today, everyone is utterly amazed when they hear me brag about it. I suspect more of us might consider it if 30 or 40 unrelenting years on the job didn't burn us out to the point of exhaustion. Retirement is our last chance to indulge ourselves. The guarantee of a government pension to secure a leisure-filled retirement was not installed without a fight, and is now the source of much alarm and worry about the future of the next generation of retirees, which is aging baby boomers like me. Boomers, though, are going to look a lot more like my dad. For one thing, boomers will live longer on average. And while there are growing concerns among medical researchers about the eventual impact of obesity, boomers are likely to enjoy better health and vitality in their old age than previous generations. In 1930, a person who reached 65 could expect to live an average of 12 more years. Nowadays, it's over 17 more years. 70 is the age today that would be comparable to the retirement age of 65 in 1930. The challenge for boomers will be deciding whether to tack on our extra years of health and vitality to our old age or our midlife, or to entirely reinvent what aging means. Boomers will have more options than the prior generation because the numbers of young people following them will be a smaller cohort, not a larger one, thus creating a need and a place for anyone who is motivated like my dad. The coming imperative for boomers to rethink retirement gives them more than a chance to stay active. It gives them a chance to give back in a way never possible before. Boomers will have the chance to work not because they have to do something for themselves, but because they want to do something for others. Part-time work, cycling in and out of the workforce, is one way in which boomers can keep their minds, experience, and talents from going to waste. We boomers have accomplished much. We will have an unprecedented opportunity to accomplish more during a time that needs all we have to offer and even more than that. Then maybe I could brag on my generation as well as my dad that we too put our good fortune to good use. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders who just released the new report, Kids in Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.